From time to time, we love to put on guest lunches like this to give city workers an opportunity to explore some of the big questions of life and to ask questions of the Christian faith, to lob objections, as it were, and try and find some answers to them. We're delighted to have Pete Williams with us today. Pete is a London lad by background. He was born in London back in 1970, became a Christian at the age of 12. While up at school in Yorkshire, studied both Latin and Greek, but without any hint of Geoffrey Boycott's accent, I'm told. Then went on to Cambridge, fully resolved to be a Bible translator with the rest of his life, and did his first of numerous degrees in Latin, Greek, Hebrew and Aramaic. I have asked him to speak to us in English today. After doing a PhD, he went on to teach both at Cambridge and at Aberdeen universities before being appointed back in 2007 as the warden of Tyndale House in Cambridge. When he's not studying Syriac versions of 1 Kings or wrestling with the use of early versions of the New Testament, he assures me that he likes relaxing with his wife Catherine, rolling around on the carpet with their 2 children, Magdalena and Leo, and playing the piano to relax. Before Pete comes and speaks, and you get a chance to ask your questions, Alex Leggett is going to come and read from page 61 of these green Gospels that you'll find on the tables. Page 61 of Luke's Gospel.
So the reading's taken from Luke chapter 19, verses 1 to 9, and that's page 61 of these green booklets. He entered Jericho and was passing through, and there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich, and he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd he could not, because he was small of stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled, "He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner." And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost."
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm looking forward to our time together. I thought, because some of you use numbers regularly, I would just test out some of my numbers on you. But what I want to do is share with you some of the reasons that I think the Gospels that you have in the Bible, as they recount Jesus' life, are credible historical documents. I want to begin with some of the things on the second page of the handout, where what we see is some of the non-Christian accounts about early Christianity. You might well say, well, why should I trust what the Christians say about how Christianity began? After all, they're a bit biased. Of course, someone being biased doesn't mean they're wrong. If you're falsely accused of something, you might feel very strongly that you want to defend yourself, and you wouldn't want your witness discounted just because you had a vested interest in your innocence. But here, we see a couple of non-Christian accounts about early Christianity. Now, I'm not going to read them out, but I just want to summarize a few of the things that you'd be able to read in them. The first one is an account by a Roman living in Rome around the year 64. He's just a young child, and he writes this up quite a bit later. But around the year 64, there was a great fire in Rome, and Nero, the emperor, was suspected of having started the fire. Of course, that made his popularity ratings sink down, and so he decided to boost them by blaming the Christians for having started the fire. And in that account, it talks about how he blamed the Christians, and what it says is there were a very large number of Christians in Rome in the year 64, that they were named after Christ, and that this Christ had been put to death in the reign of Tiberius, which is sometime between the year 14 and 37, and that was done by the procurator Pontius Pilate. That means sometime between the year 26 and 36, which gives you a rough date for when Christianity began. It also confirms that Christianity began in Judea, and then it spread all the way to Rome. Now, one of the things about that is, just in terms of giving you a sense of distance, Christianity in about 35 years has spread from Judea to Rome, which is roughly the distance you would have between Rome and the top of the Shetland Islands, just to give you some perspective on that. In a fairly short time, Christianity spreads and the Christians suffer for it. It talks about how they are torn to death by dogs or put up on crosses and burned to serve as lamps by night. So that's how difficult it was being a Christian. Christianity spread far, and it spread fast. There were large numbers. The next record is from about 80 years after the beginnings of Christianity, but this time in a part of northern Turkey called Bithynia, the governor is writing to the Emperor Trajan himself, asking for advice as to how he should deal with Christians. There are too many Christians around. What should he do with them? Well, he wants to kill all of those who persist as Christians and let off all of those who renounce Christianity under pressure. And then again, he talks about what had happened when he interrogated some people who had been Christians and then they renounced it. And he says about what they describe as an early Christian meeting before the time they'd given up being Christians, whether it was 3 years before or maybe 20 years before. Now, he's writing around the year 112, so here we're describing a first century Christian meeting, something towards the end of the first century, and it talks about how they meet on a fixed day and they sing a song to Christ as to God or as to a God. It's very striking that the idea of worshipping Christ was not something, according to Dan Brown, you know, it's something that grew up over a long period of time as people had more and more exalted ideas of Jesus. In fact, even according to a non-Christian account, it's something which was there pretty early on. Now, some people hold to the view that gradually over time, as people told stories about Jesus, they got to more and more exalted views of him. First, they thought he was a very special man, then a very, very special man, and then somewhere on the way to God, and eventually he becomes God himself. One of the problems for that belief is that Christianity, everyone agrees, Christianity began in the midst of Judaism. And Jews only worship one God. They only believe in one God. And that means that unlike in the Greek arena, where they're happy to believe in many gods, or where they're happy to believe that you can be half God and half human, the Jews didn't have that category of someone halfway on the way to God. So there simply isn't a way to go gradually through a number of steps to get from being merely human to being God, unlike with the Greek conception. So we have to ask the question, how is it that people came to worship Jesus Christ? Well, it can't have been something that just developed through many steps. And then Pliny, the governor of northern Bithynia, says something more to the emperor. He says that so many people have become Christians in his area that it in fact is having a huge effect on the economy. It's affecting things so that the temples are almost deserted, and he ends up by saying it's been hard to find a purchaser for sacrificial meat. Now imagine sharing that with the emperor about your area. But it shows just how many people became Christians. And of course, they're suffering for it. Now, I think I'd like to establish that as something of the framework for understanding the beginnings of Christianity. Because some people have this idea that gradually over time, the story just evolves as it passed from one mouth to another. But I think Christianity spreads so fast that actually it's very hard for them to be making up the message on the hoof. It's like trying to alter your advertising campaign when you've already started. And so, actually, when they don't have the infrastructure, how can they change things halfway through? How can they, after 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years, decide to make fundamental changes to the Christian message? When there are so many Christians around, how can they go around all of those different places and persuade them to adopt new beliefs? So those are some initial things that give me confidence in what we learn about in the Gospels. But I want to share a few more things. One of the things we could do with any records is we could test their knowledge of the time and place that they claim to be writing about. And here's where the numbers come in. We could look at their knowledge of architecture. We could look at their knowledge of particular plants. We could look at their knowledge of the way society is stratified. Does it match up with the town or the city, the society they're claiming to write about? Now here, I've been greatly helped by the fact that recently people have gathered statistics on the frequency of personal names in Judea at the time of Jesus and in surrounding centuries. There are about 2,953 of these names that have been gathered from sources like the Dead Sea Scrolls or historians like Josephus, the DSS stands for Dead Sea Scrolls, or ossuaries, which are boxes people used to put bones in after people died. And often they would write the name on the box. And you can actually get these names and you can make some frequency about them. Now, my abbreviation NT in the handout there, just under point one, stands for the New Testament. We find some rather striking things. I'm afraid there are more male names to go by than there are female names, but they also become more statistically significant. And I gave you these numbers because some of you might want to do some calculations and catch me out later. But what we find is the most frequent name outside the New Testament for a Jewish man happens to be the most frequent name inside the New Testament, and that's a pattern that's showing up across four different writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, writing five different books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. The second most frequent name outside the New Testament is also the second most frequent name inside the New Testament. Now let's just remember that, of course, the people back then did not have access to the statistics that we now have. These have been recently compiled by scholars. So what we're seeing is when they name characters, they are giving them credible names. The most frequent female name in the New Testament is Mary. It's also the most frequent name outside the New Testament. If you were to take something like, let's take the top nine male names outside the New Testament, you get 41% of men had those names. Inside the New Testament, you get 40%. The correlation is really very, very close, and I'm told by those who know better that it is statistically significant. But you can work that out for yourselves. You don't have to take my word for it. So there are some significant things that are going on. Now, if people were simply making up stories and putting in names to make it sound credible, would they be likely to get this sort of pattern? One of the striking things is that people seem to agree, scholars of all different convictions agree, that the Gospels were actually written in different towns. They were written by people who were spread out over a wide area, and often they were spread outside the land itself. So how on earth can they get this sort of detail right? Well, I think they can get it right either if they have been eyewitnesses and have travelled away, or they have spoken to eyewitnesses. And so one of the things we find is that with the most popular names, they actually have something extra. I've said Simon was the most popular male name. Jesus, in fact, had two disciples called Simon. And one of them was called Simon with a surname Peter, Simon Peter. The other one was Simon with another surname, Simon the Zealot. And so what you find is with the most frequent names, they add something extra to distinguish them. Because, of course, otherwise you get rather confused. But what's so striking is they don't do it with the other names. So what we're finding is even the way they talk about characters is very credible for the time and place. You could get a list like the list of disciples in Matthew chapter 10. And you could find, you could go through that list and all of the most frequent names occur with some qualifier. All of the less frequent names occur without one. It's a very striking pattern. And yet that is showing up according to our modern statistics. How could someone invent such a pattern? Well, in your business work, do you ever find it difficult to remember names? Anyone going to confess to finding it difficult to remember names? I mean, actually, names are quite hard. There are times when you can remember, you know, exactly someone's position in a company. You can remember exactly what deals they've done. You can remember things about their achievements. It's just their name that escapes you. You know, names are actually very hard to remember because there's no logical correlation, normally no logical correlation, between a name and a person. So how on earth Do you manage to connect the name and the person? In fact, names are one of the first things you forget. Now, some people might say, well, can't they get these sort of details right, and yet the message have changed over time? So, yes, they've got knowledge of time and place, but does that mean the message is right? One of the things we know is that if you tell a story, one of the first things to get missed out, if you, you know, tell a story about, you know, some friend's adventures, one of the first things that people will forget is the names. They will actually remember the story. What's more, if something is passed from mouth to mouth, you know, the sort of Chinese whispers version of how Christianity began, I don't know whether you've ever heard it likened to that, it's, again, the names are going to be the first things that are going to get corrupted in the message. Well, that's just one example of knowledge of place and time, but in fact, we find many others. I've given you another one on the second page of the handout. I've given you the four Gospels we have in the New Testament, and I put alongside them some other Gospels, some which have become quite popular in the media. You know, the Gospel of Thomas or Mary or Judas. Shouldn't these Gospels be the really authentic ones? Well, I think the other Gospels do come from considerably later, and in fact they show us what would happen if someone tries to make a story up. They just don't do anything that sounds at all credible. Now, one of the striking things there is if you get an English Bible and you go through and you look and say, how frequent are place names in the four Gospels? You'll find that all four Gospels have between 4.6 and 4.9 place names per 1,000 words. Now, that's a very, very striking thing, because one of the things that ancient authors did not do, generally, is count words. I mean, before printing, you're dealing with manuscripts, going through and just counting words like that. Is it really credible that one author might talk to another author and say, you know, Luke says to Mark, well, you know, Mark, how many words have you got? How many names have you got in your, you know, place names have you got in your book? I want to get the same proportion, not just the same number, the actual same proportion. It's a very striking thing. If people were putting in place names to make it sound authentic, they wouldn't get this sort of correlation. So how do they get it? Well, my view is that what would happen if people are basically relating what happened and that they're placing it in space and time is that over enough of a narrative, a long enough stretch of text, yes, those sort of numbers might well even out. But what you're not going to get that is that sort of correlation if people are simply putting these in for verisimilitude. What about that passage we had from Luke at the beginning? Is it a credible story? Well, firstly, we've got a figure called Zacchaeus. Is his name credible? Perfectly credible. What about the fact that he lived in a town called Jericho and was a chief tax collector? Is that a sort of place where a chief tax collector would be? Of course, it was a main trade route. Exactly where you'd put a chief tax collector. What about thing that he is inside the city and he climbs up inside a sycamore tree? Is that a credible story? Well, one of the things we could do is we could study the distribution of Ficus sycamoris, this sort of tree, and find out where it was in those days. And one of the striking things is you will find there was no such thing in Turkey or Greece or Italy. They just didn't exist. So no one in those countries could even have made up a story mentioning this sort of tree. It just wouldn't have been credible. How would anyone know there was a sycamore tree? Well, in fact, you can go today and you can see a sycamore tree right inside Jericho. You know, how could someone get that story right unless it either been there or talked to someone who had been there? Now, those are the sort of details that the gospel writers are getting right all the time. If people are making it up, sooner or later, they just start making some incredible mistakes and blunders. One further reason that gives me pause about the idea that Christianity could simply have been made up is simply the inability of people in the terms of their infrastructure to make up the story. The Christians are widespread. They are also disorganized. Not like Christians nowadays sometimes. And they're divided. Now, you might think that's an objection to Christianity, but within a few decades of Christianity, we see Paul writing letters, and clearly he's a little bit out of sorts with some of the people he's writing to. So you see division early on. Now what that means, of course, is as soon as people get divided, if you're going to start changing the message, you have to change it in both groups. You have to persuade both groups to accept, you know, some sort of change. And they have no means of mass communication. They are suffering too much. They're also emphasizing truthfulness. Now, that doesn't mean that there can be no corruption. But in contexts like in business, where people emphasize truthfulness and integrity, that does reduce corruption. But one of the most strongest reasons I find why I can't believe it was made up is simply the message. What was the marketing? You know, who'd done the marketing research on this? Well, they had two central things to their message. One was they believed in the resurrection. That was right at the center. Now, that would have gone down like a lead balloon because the general Roman thought was that after life, you might escape to some non-physical, spiritual, intellectual realm. Not that you would come back physically in a body. The Romans knew that was impossible. But then even more central in the Christian message, you had the story that Jesus Christ had been crucified, that God had become a human. That was hard, you know, a Greek might believe that, I suppose, although a Jew would find that very hard to believe, wouldn't they? But for anyone to believe that God had been crucified was simply ridiculous. Because crucifixion was the way the Romans showed, they publicly shamed someone. They showed that they were in charge. And so how could someone who's been publicly shamed in that way suddenly, you know, begin to be worshipped in this sort of way? Just in terms of marketing, I just don't think it makes any sense. Unless there was something really odd going on, something like a resurrection. Well, that would explain it for me. I know resurrection's just maybe hard to believe in, you know. But the alternatives are also, well, I think harder to believe in. The alternatives would be going against all sorts of principles that I think you learn day to day in your business lives. Now, I'm not a business person, but I do think there will be some conflict there. So those are the reasons why I think that the Gospels, as they tell us about Jesus Christ, are credible. I think there are also similar reasons I could give for some other parts of the Bible, but I think I'll leave it there. And thank you for listening very attentively and open myself up for your questions.
Let me interrupt your conversations. We've had a whole stack of questions. Keep them coming in. I'll sort them as they come in and ask Pete the questions. That enables you to keep sending them in if you would like to do that. And I may well open it up to the floor if you want to come back on anything that Pete's saying in answer to the questions. Pete, first of all, Luke's gospel. How could Luke be so precise if he didn't participate in the disciples' group when Jesus was among them?
On page 3 of the Luke's Gospels that have been handed out, he talks about, right at the beginning of his book, he says, "It seemed to me good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time." One of the things that he does is he says in that about how he has spoken to eyewitnesses. Now, Luke writes two books in the New Testament, Luke's Gospel and Acts. And one of the striking things about Acts is it shows all sorts of knowledge of all over the Mediterranean. So if someone called Luke didn't write it, you'd have to have someone else doing the whole journey in order to know, the sort of have the detailed knowledge that you have, that you couldn't just look up on Wikipedia at the time. So what I think Luke has done is he spent some time, according to the book of Acts, in Jerusalem. And he spent time while he's there talking to various people involved. And he's just, you know, so I'm not saying all the Gospels are by eyewitnesses. I think Matthew and John are by eyewitnesses. I think that Luke and Mark are by people who are using a lot of eyewitness testimony. So I think that's the pattern.
Excellent. More on the historical evidence of the Gospels and their similarities and differences. Are there many differences between the four Gospels? Are they more or less compelling as a result? And what about the difference between the four Gospels, i.e. resurrection data?
Thank you. The four Gospels are pretty different. The first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have a number of things in common, and John is more different from the other three than they are from each other. And one of the things I think you can say from that is that in various things, like the resurrection accounts, what has not happened is that people have not tried to get together to fix their story. In fact, you can see there is plenty of evidence of diversity. So for me, that gives more credibility to the accounts. With the resurrection, I think there were at least six women involved in visits to the tomb. And what we have in the four Gospels is accounts told from the perspective of different women. So some people think there are differences, like whether an angel is inside or outside the tomb and when exactly they appear, but I don't think six women went into the tomb in one go. So I think there are things like that when we take difference of perspective and the potential for a group like that to split up mean that the accounts can be reconciled. But what is so striking is even though the four resurrection accounts are so different, all four of them have glorious angels, or angels, and not a glorious Jesus. So one of the things they don't give you is Jesus with sort of lights coming off him. I mean, you would have thought that would be the way, if you were going to have a resurrection, you might well do it, because, of course, later Christians believed Jesus to be in a state of glory. But in fact, they didn't. So I think there are things like that which actually, for me, make it more credible.
I'm going to ask you one more question, then throw it open to the floor if anybody would like to come back on what Pete said so far. Do differences in the chronology of the Gospels affect their authenticity? E.g., Jesus clears the temple towards the end of Matthew, but at the beginning of John.
Thank you. I think John writes in the most precise chronological way. So he's actually the one who gives us the three-year framework for Jesus' ministry and so on. I think one of the things about temple cleansings and so on is a bit like what happens, just to recount the story, Jesus goes into the temple, he doesn't like the business that's going on there, and so he kicks the people out. Well, I think if you don't like the business once, you probably don't like it another time. So for me, just as someone might get into a pub brawl several times, but, you know, I think it's quite possible that Jesus got upset at the temple business several times. Now, some people say, well, how would he have been allowed back in once he'd done it once? What you've got to remember is in the ancient times, people didn't recognize faces. There were no photos. People didn't know what people looked like. I mean, they'd heard of them. And the temple's a very big place. So, you know, there's plenty of space for that.
Anybody want to come back on anything that Pete said so far? Ask a question for clarification? Do you feel relaxed about doing it? Just stick your paw up and ask a follow-up. Okay, let's keep going. Lots of good questions here. What historical evidence is there outside the scriptures that Jesus existed?
That Jesus existed? Well, I would say that, for instance, the account we have in Tacitus tells us that Tacitus clearly believes that there's Christ, the founder of the name, one of the things is, of course, Jesus is a common name. There are, it's the sixth most common name around at the time, so he comes to be known as Christ to distinguish him from other Jesuses, if you see what I mean. And he clearly thinks that Christianity had a historical founder. When skeptics in the second century, or pagans in the second and third century, debate with Christians, they never debate that Christians had a founder called Jesus. When Jews debate with Christians, they never debate that Christians had a founder called Jesus. It's not something that has been up for debate until, I think, in the last two centuries, when a sort of hyper-skeptical wave has sometimes swept through places like Sweden, other places where those sort of stories have become more common. But the problem is, if you start saying, well, Jesus might not have existed, you could start saying that about some, you know, some Roman Caesars and so on. It starts getting into ridiculous history.
Pete, tell us, what do you say to the person if you're getting in a conversation and somebody says to you, like, I don't want the Gospels, put those to one side, give me other evidence. Do you think these are these allowed in the debate?
Well, I think the Gospels are allowed. I mean, it's a bit like asking for an account of football, but it mustn't be by anyone who's interested in football. You know, it's saying, I'm going to discount. I mean, of course, Christians are the biggest interest group involved in talking about Christianity. So there are more early Christian accounts. That's just the way things are. Or it's a bit like, you know, I want an account of business, but I don't want anyone involved in business to tell me about it. It would be a ridiculous thing. So what we have to do is we have to discern and say, well, is this credible? I mean, I think to say I am simply going to reject anything that Christians say out of hand is not really a reasonable position to take.
Okay, well, here's another question a bit like that. Do we have witness accounts of miracles not reported by the four Bible writers? Do we have independent historical reports?
Well, firstly, I don't think it's just the four Bible writers. I think there are at least nine writers in the New Testament that tell us about Jesus' miracles. And we also know that when the Jews, in their sources, the Talmud and the Mishnah, particularly the Talmud, talk about Jesus, for him, in those accounts, often he is a sorcerer, but everyone agrees that he was believed to have performed miracles. So when there's a skeptic in the second century who debates with a Christian, someone called Celsus, he does not deny that Jesus was believed to have performed miracles. What in fact he denies is he says that he was doing it as a magician and so on. So one of the striking things is that no one seems to have debated that Jesus actually performed miracles.
I'll throw it open in a minute, so do be thinking of your comeback if you'd like to. I guess the greatest miracle in the Gospels is the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And here's a good question. Can you give some examples of why you think it's harder not to believe in the resurrection?
Well, I mean, one of the things I suppose you have to say about, you know, what's hard and easy to believe is a lot of it starts on some prior convictions. Of course, there are some people who are so convinced that there is no God, are so convinced that our world is a simply closed system, that however much evidence they see for the resurrection, they won't actually believe. When you study the New Testament accounts, one of the things you see is clearly the early Christians took some convincing themselves. Simply having someone appear in front of them wasn't enough on its own to convince them of the resurrection. And with the resurrection, we have two lines of argument. One is the absence of the body, which seems to be well documented, that there was no body in the tomb on the third day. And the other thing is a number of appearances. Now, let's just consider the diversity of appearances. We have them by prior appointment, without prior appointment. We have them singly and in groups. We have them at distance. We have them close up. We have them morning. We have them evening. We have them in Judea. We have them in Galilee. The variety, including people thinking, talking about eating with him, is very, very different from modern apparitions. It's just not that sort of thing that you can speak of. And of course, when you read the Gospels, they're clearly written by people who think that the early Christians abandoned Jesus before he was crucified. So it's not exactly propaganda to bolster the very first people telling the account. But by the second generation of Christianity, people used to say nice things about the early leaders. It's only the first generation that aren't so, don't whitewash them. So I think what we've got with the resurrection accounts is very, very early accounts.
Anybody want to come back on that? That's the central claim, isn't it? That's the greatest miracle. Anybody want to come back with a gap in Pete's argument that you've spotted or a question?
I know some gaps, but it takes more time.
Don't provide the gaps as well. Pete, tell us, just give us an insight into how you first discovered the truth about the resurrected Jesus for yourself.
Well, I had the privilege of being brought up in a Christian family, and so I was told of Christ by my parents. And I came around the age of 12 to be convinced of the truth of that. And everything since then has validated that. I went through a period going to university where, of course, you're exposed to all sorts of other ideas. And you have to evaluate, have I come to the right convictions? And coming through that time, I really came to the view that there isn't any other explanation for the universe which is so comprehensive. Some people might say, well, you are just a Christian because you were brought up in a Christian family, to which, of course, the retort might be, you are simply not a Christian if you're not a Christian, because you're brought up in a society which is largely post-Christian. So, it's postcode lottery either way. So you have actually to get down to, details on the reasons for belief.
Two last questions, and then we'll draw stumps. What about the different versions of the books of the Bible and the different translations, all used to push one point or another?
Different versions, I mean, I travel in all sorts of lands and I meet people who, you know, are reading the Bible. I've never met them before and I find we've been reading the same Bible. People may have problems with the European Union, but one of the problems they don't seem to have is that they're worried that in translation, the European Union documents are becoming radically changed. Somehow people, you know, have this idea that because the Bible has been translated, there's been some radical change. Well, I mean, I studied ancient languages, and it's no more different than reading Dostoevsky in terms of, you know, Russian to English. Not that I read Russian, but, you know, I don't think it's any more different. That's one point. And of course, one of the things is that the evidence for the documentation, the early manuscripts, is getting earlier all the time. So in Oxford, every couple of years, they're publishing earlier and earlier manuscripts of the New Testament. It's quite exciting.
Pete, thank you very much. We've run out of time.